You want to get rid of that pop-up window?
She has the mouse.
How did you?
I'm remoting. This thing's awesome.
Wow, we just had a little technical leap here. Betty's sitting off in amongst the listeners, and she's controlling the computer with the mouse on her lap. So that's pretty cool. Okay. So today's talk is, I'm calling it, do we have a Buddhist Bible? This was yet another question submitted. I asked for people to submit Dharma questions or topics. And so I encourage you to do that. I actually made a little button for the front page of the website, submit a Dharma question or topic to Domio. And I think we put it back in the newsletter. So I think I've received four questions so far, and that's what I've done my last four Dharma talks on. So if you submit a question, I'm probably actually going to address it. So this was, somebody didn't ask whether we had a Buddhist Bible, but the similar question, just like, what about all the sutras and texts and what are you supposed to read and, what's essential? So depending on your character and your relationship to study or texts or your relationship to religion in general over the course of your life, it's natural for many of us when we're new to Buddhism to want to get our head around the essential teachings and texts. Clearly, we realize there's a lot of teachings and there's a lot of terms and there's a lot of texts, and so what should we do? What should we read? What should we study? What should we know? And it's certainly when I first was delving into Zen, I was like, where is the Buddhist Bible? Where is the equivalent of the Buddhist Bible? And I remember looking in the bookstore and gleefully discovering and picking up Dwight Goddard's The Buddhist Bible. So Dwight Goddard lived from 1861 to 1939. And the Buddhist Bible was originally published in 1932. So if you're curious, you can get a Kindle version for 99 cents now. And this was the first anthology of Buddhist teachings in English, specifically with a Zen orientation, and had a great influence in the development of Western Zen. So apparently, there was a Tricycle magazine article on this a number of years ago on this book and how it influenced Zen. And I guess it was one of Jack Kerouac's first books. Ah, there, Bob. Bob has a Buddhist Bible. And it's 622 pages, but when you compare it with all the Buddhist texts, all the Buddhist texts that are out there, right? Like, it's at least, here's a place to start. So Goddard was a Christian missionary in China, and he later went on to other work, but was always fascinated by China. And he encountered Japanese Zen in the U.S. in 1928 at age 67. And it said he was he had gone through some rough times in his life, and this article said he was terribly moved that he never knew Zen Buddhism until he was 67. But, and this is a quote from that Tricycle article, Goddard did not intend a Buddhist Bible to be a source book for critical and literary study. In a letter to Ruth Everett, later Ruth Fuller Sasaki, he said about another of his publications, "Whatever I do will inevitably be done in an amateurish way and will have to be redone later by abler minds. But I feel that because of the present situation, I must do the best I can and remain willing to be forgotten by the great writers who are to follow." So it is easy now to criticize Goddard's Buddhist Bible 90 years after he published it. So for one thing, he chose to translate selections from four Mahayana sutras, three of which, at least, are incredibly dense. These are not easy to comprehend or understand, even if you have been studying Buddhism for years and years and years. This is not where you send a beginner. But then, you know, I mean, he was a Bible. Like, he wasn't claiming that it was the intro to, you know, the easy way. But also, we now have a much fuller understanding of Zen and Buddhism in the West, thanks to Asian teachers who taught Westerners who went to Asia, or they came over here and they taught, to Westerners who traveled to Asia to train. We now have generations of people who have been actually practicing and, you know, developing a real experiential understanding of Buddhism and Zen. So, and decades of translations of Buddhist texts. And over time, you know, translation, the process of translation, as this kind of thing gets introduced to, for instance, to our Western cultures, to our English-speaking cultures, through trial and error, we find the ways that certain concepts are most effectively communicated. So it might not have been the choice of the initial translator, but after a while, through actually teaching and, you know, practicing with English speakers, then we develop ways of phrasing things and describing things, a vocabulary of our own. So this influences more modern translations. So that means usually, not always, later translations are more accurate, less biased by the translator's own limited understanding of the culture or the language of the text, and then influenced in this positive way by the evolving understanding of native practitioners. And even to have selected these four texts and put them in something called a Buddhist Bible is very bold. So I'm going to give you a little overview of Buddhist texts, and then revisit this question of, like, now what do we do? So we have the Pali Canon, which was an oral tradition for hundreds of years after the Buddha's death. And for at least part of the Pali Canon is the suttas, it's the discourses of the Buddha. And so according to the story, which you can take with a grain of salt if you like, but according to the story, he had a disciple with an eidetic memory, and he was able to recite back everything that the Buddha had ever taught, because he had been the Buddha's constant companion for his whole teaching career. So this is, you know, believed by many that this is like the suttas in the Pali Canon are what the Buddha said. And then there's other parts in the Pali Canon too, the monastic regulations and philosophical texts. But even just of the suttas, there are 10,000 suttas. Many are short, like one page or less. But even just the suttas are about five times the length of the Christian Bible in printed form. And the Christian Bible is not short, you know, it's a good 1,000 pages as well. So then from early on, probably starting a few hundred years after the Buddha's death, new texts began to be developed. In original Buddhism, the canon was held in very high regard, and it still is, especially by Theravadan Buddhism, for which they're central and only texts. And they're held to be very special. You know, the Buddha taught these things. But we have no deity in Buddhism. So even the canon is not divinely inspired. The whole reason we revere the Buddha is because he discovered and taught a path of practice that can be followed by any human being, and that it is possible for any one of us to awaken just as he did. So if there were no enlightened people after the Buddha, he would have failed in his task. So therefore, at least in theory, experienced and tested practitioners of Buddhism and Zen throughout the centuries can speak with their own authority about practice. So maybe it may be that few, if any, teachers have ever surpassed the brilliance of the Buddha. But on the other hand, each teacher in each different location or generation is probably going to be able to communicate the Dharma in a way that's more understandable to their students than perhaps like now the Pali Canon is 2,500 years old and sounds a little dated. So, you know, a modern teacher explaining and expressing it in modern terms is very helpful. So because of this, you know, we don't have just, these are divinely inspired texts, and each teacher who realizes the way can speak on their own authority. So this is why the Mahayana Sutras, which started to take form over the course of a couple hundred years, from about the first century BCE to the first century CE, they emphasize skillful means. So there has many stories in the Mahayana Sutras about the Buddha using, you know, sometimes even maybe it kind of looks like a little white lie or something, but it's just to wake beings up. So there's a classic story of like, there's a father, he's got a bunch of kids and they ingest poison and it's made them crazy and they won't take the antidote to the poison. So he like leaves and sends back word that he's died. And then like the children are shocked out of their stupor and then they take the antidote. So that's like, it's kind of this explanation of the Mahayana Sutras because they try to gain the legitimacy by putting their teachings in the mouth of the Buddha. They say the Buddha said this, the Buddha said that. And it's like, wait a second. It's like, so you had all of these diligent students around the Buddha and they set down this canon and they kept it by oral tradition, which was viewed as more reliable than the written tradition for a long time and was only written down in the first century BCE. And they missed these things. They just like, oh yeah. So then the Mahayanists say, well, the Buddha kind of used supernatural powers to kind of skip out on his disciples and go do these teachings somewhere else. And then these sutras were saved. They were hidden for hundreds of years until people were ready for them. I don't know. I always find that kind of amusing. So, you know, I mean, they're trying to gain a legitimacy for these teachings, some of which are fairly new, by putting them in the words of the Buddha, because they're surrounded by Buddhists who revere this, like, you know, the Buddha said this, the Buddha said that. So, you know, they're trying to carve some new territory in there. But it wasn't long after this period where you didn't even have to make up those kinds of stories anymore. Just especially as writing spread, you know, so there's many texts that are a little more anonymous, like they just kind of got compiled over a long period of time. But eventually, you know, people are actually putting their names to things, and there's philosophers and there's commentators and all that. So there's begins to be a growth in Buddhist texts. So I'm going to go over a very brief list of them before returning to our central question. So we have, and I wish I'd brought in book show and tell, but you know, that would have been would have been quite a stack of books. So, and you don't have to remember all of these. You know, a lot of this is listed on my podcast website. We have the Mahaprajnaparamita Sutras. These are the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And there's a basic version in 8,000 lines, but there was also 18,000, 25,000, 100,000 lines. Then it was also shortened to with 300 lines, the Diamond Sutra, and 25 or 14 lines, which is the Heart Sutra, which is what we chant during our services. So So the Heart Sutra is like, it's the heart of the teaching, right? So it's like 8,000 lines distilled down to the essence. So just for perspective, there's only one translation I know of the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 lines. Hopefully a new one will be coming out soon. That's by Edward Kanza, and his translation is 352 pages. Then there is the Lotus Sutra, which they think probably was compiled around the first century CE. And I have some podcast episodes on that, and these sutras are very different. When you read them sometimes, it's just like, what does this have to do with Zen? And it seems like quite a departure too from the Pali canon. Does have some flowery supernatural stuff if you look, but a lot of it is just very down to earth. The Buddha is talking to his disciples and he says, you know, this is a problem, and if you meditate this way, you can take care of this. And it's pretty down to earth. But these Mahayana sutras, it's like the Buddha has supernatural powers and he floats up on a, you know, lion throne into the sky, and he helps everybody see into infinite other domains where there's a Buddha in every domain, and they're kind of far out. So I talk about some of that on the podcast. It's kind of a topic for another day, but so the Lotus Sutra is 504 pages, the Jean Reeves translation. There's the Vimalakirti Sutra, another very early, like, we don't know who the author is. And this is a very unique sutra in that it's from the point of view of a layperson. So very early on, Mahayana Buddhism kind of challenged the ideas of the original Buddhism that if you really wanted to practice, you had to leave home and become a monk and do this. You know, like, you'd follow 250 rules. You couldn't dig in the soil because you might kill a worm and that would be bad for your practice. But then you had to be reliant on lay people to go do that for you, right? You have to eat. So the Vimalakirti Sutra basically just, it calls attention to the fact that what we're aiming for is deeper than that. That if what we're trying to awaken to is limited by, you know, the details of how many rules we live by in our life or whatever, this is, that's a very limited way of relating to the Dharma. So Vimalakirti is a completely awakened layman who's also, I got a family and business and all that, and basically he does Dharma combat with all the Buddha's main disciples. And they're all his disciples are like, I don't want to debate this guy. He's got such an understanding. No, 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 please don't make me go debate Vimalakirti. So that's an interesting sutra. That's 192 pages. There's the Lankavatara Sutra. And, I was going to read something from a book that I forgot to bring up with me. Anyway, that's 320 pages, and that is quite... that was a big challenge in a way to a whole bunch of Buddhist philosophy that had been happening in the many hundreds of years since the Buddha's death, which boiled down the world into dharmas, dharmas with a capital D. Dharmas were essential things. There was like, they didn't know about atoms, but in a way it was like, these are the essential components of reality. And then they categorized them, and that was a very elaborate, and they practiced like the Buddha taught, not self, like this is not self, these things are impermanent and whatever. But the Lankavatara Sutra, in essence, I mean, I have not studied it in depth, but what Red Pine was saying was essentially it's saying there's only dharmas because you think there are dharmas. It has a very strong emphasis on the mind and how all of this is us parsing the world out into pieces. There's no inherent reality to any of that. So that's pretty radical. So it's considered quite a core Zen text. And that, yeah. Then there's the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is in a completely different ball of wax. It's the main text of several different schools of Buddhism. It's 1,856 pages long. It's like this thick. Even the Kindle version is $78. And talk about flowery. I mean, there's like 20 pages just describing the names of the bodhisattvas who showed up to hear a particular discourse by the Buddha. But it has some amazing stuff in it as well. And that's not all the anonymous author sutras by any means, but some of the core ones. And then we have an explosion of Chan texts in China. So koan collections, they start collecting teaching stories of these interactions between teacher and student. There's commentaries, there's poetic teachings, many of which we recite and study. There is the Platform Sutra of Huineng, or the sixth patriarch, and that's a very fascinating story of his awakening. Jumping way ahead, we have by writings from Dogen, our Soto Zen Dharma father, and Kaz Tanahashi's translation of his Shobo Genzo, which is not the only writings he did, is 1,515 pages long. And then we have contemporary teachers, writers of books and podcasts and all of this. So where do you begin? What is essential? What should our relationship be to all of these texts and teachings? By comparison, if the Christian Bible is, you know, there's depends on the size of the text, right? But if it's, say, around 1,000 pages long, the just the text that I've specifically mentioned by name and given you the page numbers, that adds up to almost 10,000 pages. And many of these texts are very dense and challenging to study on your own. So, I came up with four principles for studying Zen and Buddhist texts. The first is that remember always, and you've probably heard me say this before, that Buddhist teachings and texts are not meant to fill your head with even more ideas. They are meant to challenge the ideas you already have. So it's not about accumulating a whole bunch of terms and philosophies and ideas and concepts. It's just the whole point is to break through our delusions, these assumptions that we make about the world, the views that we have about the world, the views that we have about self. Therefore, study is very valuable. But quantitative mastery or extensive memorization is not necessary. So unless you're studying Buddhism at a university, learning the text just for the sake of learning the text, there's no qualifying exam for Buddhists. So hopefully you can take some solace in that. The second principle is to be patient and steady. So there's no way you're going to read, let alone fully comprehend, all Buddhist texts in your lifetime. But if you keep up a steady, sustainable pace with your study, one you might be able to keep up for decades, you will be surprised at how familiar you can become with various texts and teachings just gradually over time. You'll start soaking in the terminology and concepts and, you know, which at first were just like, you know, want to explode your head. And then, you know, 5, 10 years later, you're like, yeah, well, you know, emptiness, suchness, what, you know, start spilling these words off your tongue. And then the third, in choosing what to study, it's good to have a balance between following your own interests and affinities, but also challenging yourself to engage more difficult texts if you get the opportunity. Like we're doing on Tuesdays, we're studying Dogen's Genjo Koan, which is a little, you know, okay, I try to, you know, start each class by thinking like, okay, so how can people walk away from this class not just going, what? What was that? So it is good, it's helpful to engage the challenging text, particularly if you get a chance to do it in a class, do it with Sangha, do it with some kind of support like that. But then particularly if you are doing study on your own, which many of us, much of our study happens that way, then it's really completely fine to just kind of like follow your nose. You hear some lines of something and it makes you curious or you resonate with it. Maybe you even just think it's beautiful. And then you look into it, and if it draws you in some more, you know, focus on that. And then generally one text will just lead to another. And then you can, you know, go, you can just go into the bookstore and seeing what intrigues can be a good way to go about it. Because you kind of have to feel some resonance with the text, or kind of like it. It has to be a little bit accessible if you're going to study it on your own. And then the fourth is to engage the teachings with an open mind, but also feel free to wrestle with them. So I have a whole podcast episode about this relating to Buddhist teachings, their abundance, diversity, and authenticity. And I talk about wrestling with the teachings. So the texts and teachings can shape your thinking in a positive way. It's giving you new ways to frame your experience, giving you new practices, tools for practice. But sometimes the teachings can also seem obscure, alien, not at all what you expected, overly philosophical, or overly devotional, or overly supernatural, perhaps life-denying, or mystical, or whatever. So when you encounter something challenging, my Dharma grandmother Roshi Kennett used to say, you are right to doubt what you think it means. So, you know, if you encounter something, I can't think too much off the top of my head, except maybe, for example, you know, according to the Pali Canon Suttas, the Buddha didn't want to admit women as nuns. And when Ananda finally convinced him to do it, because he said, didn't you say all beings, including women, can awaken? And he's like, well, yes. And he said, well, then, you know, you should allow them to ordain. And then the Buddha says, well, okay, but that means the Dharma is going to degenerate much faster. You know, and so what? How do you hold that? You know, like, do you say, well, that was just, you know, he was just sexist. But then what else do we doubt or throw out? And, you know, so there you might, I find generally in Buddhism, there's not as much you might encounter as you would in like the Christian Bible that makes you go, wait a second. But there are teachings, they can bother you at a more subtle level too. Like there's one text is like faith and mind, and it talks all about not choosing right or wrong, or, you know, discriminating in any way. And if you do, your mind is, you know, in delusion and whatever. And there's, I felt a great resistance to that about, well, I don't want to give up my discrimination, right? I don't want to look at the injustice and destruction in the world and go, well, I didn't want to lose my ability to discriminate right from wrong, right? So I felt the resistance to that teaching that lasted until, you know, I got a different understanding of it, and I could see where both could be possible, that we could surrender our sense that our view is inherently, you know, based in something inherently real, but still stand up for it. So if you do encounter that kind of challenging thing, you know, I mean, the Buddhist texts are not divinely inspired. They were assembled by people. A teaching that was skillful 2,000 years ago might not be now. A teaching that is skillful for one person might be toxic for another person. So that's a valuable thing to remember as well. That's the Mahayanists with their skillful means point that out. You know, the Dharma is like medicine. It's prescribed for certain kinds of suffering. So not all the medicine is meant for you. And you might talk about what you're reading or studying with Sangha members or a teacher. So those are my four principles. Remember, the texts are not meant to fill your head with more ideas, but to challenge the ideas you already have. Be patient and steady. In choosing what to study, follow your interests and affinities, but also challenge yourself to engage with more difficult texts if you get the opportunity. You don't have to. It's not obligatory. If you feel a lot of resistance to study, you know, it depends on your relationship to it, because there's some people who recognize in themselves that they have maybe over-intellectualized much of what they've done in their life. You know, you go read and you study and you figure it out. And that, so they're cautious about, like, their own desire to just read and study and figure Buddhism out. So there's a place for that too, of recognizing, you know, it's not always time for study. But then you run the risk of not having the ideas you already have challenged. And I do have on the Zen Studies podcast website, I have a suggested syllabus. So not all of it is based on Buddhist texts, but I start with, if you're curious about just, well, where do you start in your study? This was my recommendation. So it starts with the Buddha's life as archetypal teaching. So learning about his life, not because he's some kind of divine being or whatever, but because the story of his life has teaching in it. And I have episodes on the core teachings of the Buddha. So, you know, Eightfold Path, Four Noble Truths, and Anatta, not self, and the basic building blocks, which we don't even necessarily talk about a lot in Zen, but it's kind of assumed that that's kind of a foundational building block. So I think it's very helpful to have a basic understanding of those. I'd have some episodes I recommend on Zazen, the essentials of Zen practice. And then I also share just a very short list of important texts to start with. So I made a selection of 12 Pali Canon Suttas. Most of them are pretty short. And there's many that are great, but these are a good place to start. And then I recommended the Heart Sutra, which I talk about on the podcast, and then Genjo Koan, which I have podcast episodes on, but we're also studying on Tuesdays. I mean, and that's like, the Lotus Sutra is important too. I have a couple episodes on that. Avatamsaka Sutra, strangely, is important to our lineage. I gained an appreciation for, I was exposed to most of this stuff through Dharmarine Zen Center's seminary program. So they have a program, it's not relevant outside the walls of their Zen Center. Seminary sounds like it's, you know, really amazing, but it's not accredited or anything like that. It's just for members of their Zen Center to study these things. So there'll be a whole class on the Lotus Sutra, there'll be a whole class on the, Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, there'll be a whole class on Dogen, or whatever. And there was a class on the whole history of Buddhism, and I taught this myself once, and bringing in texts along the way to kind of put them in context. And I was exposed to many things through those classes that I wouldn't have otherwise discovered. I mean, if I had just been following my nose would not have led me. in that direction. In fact, I've talked about this before, but I had an extremely negative reaction to the Lotus Sutra when I first read it, particularly because everybody around me was like, oh, I just love this sutra. It speaks to me. I love it. And I'm like, there was many reasons why I had a bad reaction. But that was okay. You know, I could express my skepticism. I didn't have to just, you know, swallow this and like it or anything. But it ended up, you know, the Lotus Sutra ended up being one of my favorite sutras. So that I think it's useful to engage and open ourselves up, ask what this is about, go ahead and wrestle with it. And sometimes, you know, I think of this as exposing ourselves to the teachings. You never really know which ones are going to just kind of stick with you and come back. And, you know, if you've never been exposed to them, you don't know they're there. And then you can't make use of them. So I wish I had my little book. It's a little orange volume called Zen Roots, The First 1,000 Years by Red Pine. He's a translator. He's done a lot of modern translations of Zen texts. And it's in my black bag next to the... Sure. So actually, I got sent this book in order to review it, and I actually never got around to doing that. But it's like the modern take on the Buddhist Bible, you know, the Zen-oriented Buddhist Bible. And, you know, Goddard wasn't so far off. I mean, I'm sure these are much more modern translations, but, you know, so Red Pine, part of the skill of the book is like, what are you going to put in there? He tried to keep it really small. So he put the Heart Sutra, the Diamond Sutra, selections from the Vimalakirti Sutra, selections from the, thank you. So here it is. Zen Roots by Red Pine. It's not all that long. it's kind of petite too. It's kind of a neat petite book. So even with there's 276 pages, but it's like, it's not even that big a book. He has a short text by Bodhidharma. He has that Faith and Mind poem, the Platform Sutra, and two more Chan texts. So, you know, that means Goddard had something from the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. He had something from the Lankavatara. He had the Platform Sutra. And I can't remember what the other one was. But anyway, you know, I wasn't far off, really. And so I guess this is kind of the version of the Buddhist Bible. But for me, if I was to make a Buddhist Bible, like this would be like, this would, I guess it would be volume 2, this would be Zen or Mahayana or something. But I do feel like that the intro to the Buddha's life and the basic Buddhist teachings is an important part of it as well. So I'd probably do volume 1 before Mahayana, and volume 2, this could be the Mahayana section. So I would love to, you know, offer more involved study to, you know, go through this book in a class with people, but it is tricky. You know, I can only do so much, and, you know, Sundays, I feel like they need to be a very, you know, just kind of like a one-off, interesting, thought-provoking, accessible thing for people to join. And Tuesdays, even though we usually are studying something, to study the Lankavatara Sutra is like, you know, just imagine if that was your first visit to a Zen center, you're going to be, I don't know, like dharmas, and dharmas only exist in your mind, and I don't know, you know. So it really have to be another study group, which, like I said, I can only do so much. But if you are particularly on fire about study, and, you know, I mean, you want to challenge yourself more than, you know, follow my syllabus on the Zen Studies podcast website or whatever, I let me know, and I can try to connect you with Dharmarine's seminary program. I believe they will accept Bright Ways End members, I believe. I'm not sure how much accessibility each of their classes has in the cloud. I'm guessing that they're available in the cloud. Do you know something about it?
Well, I know that YNEES has just started a study of something.
Yeah, Joshin's leading some classes at Y East too, a sutra study kind of thing.
It's a night class.
Do you know what they're? I can't remember what they're studying right now. Anyway, I mean, just let me know, and I can try to hook you up with some classes that you might participate in. And then the seminary program at Dharmarine, it cost something, and you had to write papers. I think you could audit the class, but, you know, that's part of the motivation, right? Oh, now I got to write my papers, and now I actually have to read this, and I have to think about it. So that was part of the benefit, is like engaging it in that way. So I will leave it there. You have about 10 minutes for any comments or questions. Dave in the Dirt Zendo.
Hello. I'm just going to relate a little story, because this came up yesterday. In fact, I was out to lunch with a friend of mine, and just talking about how I'd gone to Powell's during the week on a whim and picked up a copy of Bendoa and related commentary. And she said something to the effect of, and I told her who wrote it and all that kind of stuff. And she said, well, aren't you afraid by reading the commentaries, it's going to like detract or dilute the original text? And I said, basically, you know, there's nothing sacred about the Bendoa. I mean, it could be special, but it's not sacred in that way. And she seemed very surprised by that. Hmm. And I think that somebody who's not in this assumes that there's going to be like, oh, this person wrote this down. There it is, you know, and I just her look of genuine surprise, I thought was interesting when I said that there's nothing sacred about it. So
I find it's like the people that we encounter in this culture, they can get their mind around you're an atheist. Okay, they got that. And they can get your mind around you're religious. But like then they figure, I mean, what if you're involved in anything that's might be called a religion, there's a God and there's sacred texts. I mean, that is just the background assumption. They cannot get their minds around something that kind of has all the other trappings of religion, but doesn't have that. And it's hard to get that point across. But I should say that different forms of Buddhism have different relationships to texts and teachings. I mean, Buddhism is more diverse than all the different kinds of Christianity. So it depends, you know, like you just read Theravadan stuff and think that's pretty down to earth, yeah. But if you actually practice with the Theravadan, maybe not all sanghas, but if you actually practice with them, they do revere the Buddha. They do think like, well, if the Buddha said it, I mean, the Buddha was completely enlightened. And so that is the deal. And which is not how I relate to this stuff at all. I mean, I had a conversation with a Theravadan monk who I really admired his teachings. And I asked him why lay people, why did the Buddha teach that, you know, you had to get ordained in order to achieve complete enlightenment or whatever? And he was just like, well, that's what he said. And I felt like I was talking to somebody about the Christian Bible, and somebody was like, well, that's the way it is. So the conversation just ended there, okay? Well, whereas, you know, for me, and I think for, which is probably very true in Zen in particular, it's about your own, you verify the truth of it for yourself. So it becomes a valuable teaching when you recognize that this is helpful to you, not because somebody said it. So that's been an essential piece of it for me. Yeah, Shaketsu.
I went to the Y East website, and this course is starting on October 8th. So if you wanted to do it, they're doing it through October on Saturday afternoons. I was wrong. It's not a night class, Saturday afternoons. And the book is The Mountains and Waters Sutra by Joshin.
So that is a Dogen fascicle, so it's not that long. It's a Dogen essay. But just like we're studying Genjo Koan, the Mountains and Waters Sutra is another Dogen essay.
And if you want to find it, you can go to yeastzencenter.org. Y East is spelled WYEAST and then zencenter.org.
Thank you. Ted.
Daniel?
Oh, yeah. Ruth Ann, go ahead.
Yes. I participated this past Saturday in the study group, and it's a small group. I'm just, you know, zooming in on my phone, and the participants have studied this before, so it's really interesting a few years ago to have them kind of come back in. They're saying for themselves, it's good to review. And for me, anything I can pick up from Dogen, even though I didn't get the app, is still pretty astounding in that hour and a half discussion. So it's good. And I love the point you went over today for all of us. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Ted.
I had a question about, like, either in the suttas or in the Abhidharma, like, why things are, like, they'll talk about a flower and there'll be a line or a sentence about a flower and they repeat it, like, for many, many pages or in the Abhidharma. Why do they do that? It seems like, I'm reading the same thing. You're not telling me anything new
that,
as I go down.
And apparently,
it's like
I am not.
Pages and pages. And
I am,
like,
not an expert, but apparently that was an aid for oral transmission.
Oh, okay. For,
I mean, go figure. I don't know. Like, it would just seem like more material to learn from to me, but maybe the, you know, the very repetition of it, like some written translations will leave some of that out and they'll just do ellipses, you know, you kind of figure, all right. And the same goes for the other five skandhas, you know,
right.
And then da 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 da. But yeah, apparently that was, and apparently, I would love to know more. It's pretty fascinating. But apparently, oral transmission was very accurate and very efficient. And yeah, so you recognize that that's for the Pali Canon. You know, you can recognize a orally transmitted text by that repetition, which gets a little, a little old sometimes to wade through, but good question. Is anybody out there a passionate fan of study? or highly resistant to study?
I certainly was. I feel like I've fallen off quite a bit. But you know, it in some ways it's a personality thing, right? It just plugs into my personality really well. A, I really like getting to the bottom of things. And while sort of practical Buddhist teaching about how to get along in the world is useful for everybody, including lay people, when you start throwing the absolute and the relative or all phenomena are consciousness only at me. That's like catnip, right? That's getting to the absolute bottom of it. But at the same time, you know, it can absolutely become a toy, right? You can be sitting there, sitting zazen and pulling apart some teaching instead of sitting zazen, right? But it's also, if your personality is like that, it's a great way to stay engaged, right? It is a road you can walk, right? And it's good to have that under your feet.
Thank you. And one more reason for study too, besides, you know, challenging the ideas we already have is, the texts and the teachings have an influence on your mind, whether you're really conscious of it or not. It gives us all common vocabulary. And then, like, when you have an experience, I think it influences how that experience unfolds. My sense of things is that, you know, mystical experiences, awakening experiences happen to people in all, you know, all different religions or no religion or whatever. But that when you have really soaked yourself in Buddhist, like the Buddhist worldview, if you will, it will make sense to you in Buddhist terms. And I think that's a valuable, it's a valuable thing, because that kind of changing of your mind, that kind of disorientation can be disorienting. So kind of the more steeped you are in Buddhist imagery and concepts, the more you'll be like, I think that's what Dogen was talking about. You know, you have some imagery, you have some connection to it. You realize this is not a freakish experience you're having all by yourself. You're kind of connected to the ancestors who have described it many times before. And with that, I'll leave it. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.